Good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to call to order this meeting of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Happy March, everybody. We are going to start, as we always do, with the roll call to see if we have a quorum. And Ms. Niedernhofer, if you would please call the roll.
Liebling.
Present.
Hewitt.
Present.
Schumacher.
Schumacher, present.
Ackland.
Ackland, present.
Backer.
Backer, present.
Connor.
Yeah, hi.
Present.
Thank you for turning your call. I'll try you again later. Okay.
Bierman.
Present.
Bolden.
Present.
Damath.
Present.
Freiberg.
Present.
Grinhagen.
Present.
Keel.
Present.
Morrison.
Morrison, present.
Morrison, present. Munson.
Munson, present.
Pryor.
Present.
Quam. Quam. Ryer.
Present.
Schultz.
Present.
Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, present.
A quorum is present.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Niedernhofer. A quorum is present.
Quam present.
And Quam is present as well. Okay. Thank you, Representative Quam. The next order of business is to move approval of the minutes of February 26th. Is there a member who would like to move to approve the minutes?
Madam Chair, I can move the minutes.
All right. Thank you, Representative Munson moves approval of the minutes of February 26th. Is there any discussion to the minutes? All right. Seeing none, please unmute yourselves for a moment, members. All in favor of approval of the minutes of February 26th, please say aye.
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 All opposed, no. The motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Thank you, Representative Munson. Okay, the first bill that we have listed is House File 1419, but I know that Representative Hassan, who's going to present that, is possibly going to be a bit late. She's in another committee at the same time. Representative Hassan, are you present? Okay, I'm not seeing her. So we're going to skip that one just for now and move on and take up House File 19, which is Representative Morrison's bill. And Representative Morrison is here. And so Representative Morrison is going to move that House File 19 be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. So Representative Morrison, welcome, and please go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I appreciate the opportunity to present House File 19, which removes barriers to access for physician-administered drugs to treat substance use disorder. Providing access to medicines to treat substance use disorder is an increasingly important priority as we are dealing both with a pandemic and an opioid epidemic. Preliminary data recently released from the Minnesota Department of Health showed a 55% increase in opioid-related fatal overdoses from January through June 2019 in the same period in 2020. Treating substance use disorder with medications is evidence-based practice. And we need to ensure that all patients have access to these evidence-based practices, especially our most vulnerable Minnesotans covered on our fee-for-service medical assistance plan. In Minnesota, if you are among the 25% of the MA population covered under our fee-for-service plan, your access to physician-administered medicines, the class of medicines that are injectable or implantable, is severely limited. Although our Medicaid fee-for-service program covers these medicines, it is only covered as a medical benefit through a process known as buy and bill, rather than through a traditional pharmacy benefit. Buy and bill is an arrangement through which healthcare providers purchase pharmaceutical products directly from a wholesale or specialty distributor to enable them to have a supply of provider-administered medication on hand for treatment of their patients. As the term suggests, this reimbursement model requires that the healthcare provider buy the medication first and bill the patient's insurance plan after the administration of medication. In other words, physicians store the medication at their office and manage inventory on an ongoing basis. As they administer the medicines, healthcare providers bill the patients for the treatment they have administered. The healthcare providers do not receive payments for the medication until their patients' insurance claims are processed and reimbursed when covered by the payer. Many small healthcare provider practices and clinics do not have the administrative staff, necessary overhead, or resources to manage this type of inventory control, billing systems, and upfront costs. So these patients, in effect, do not have access to long-acting injectable medicines. They're instead given oral medicines, which must be taken daily. This might be fine for some patients and probably most patients, but when treating substance use disorder, medication adherence can be problematic. This is about equity. As policymakers, we need to ensure that all Minnesotans have access to the best evidence-based care to treat substance use disorders. Managed care plans and commercial plans here in Minnesota don't have this restriction on physician-administered medicines. Our fee-for-service coverage should align. Over the past few years, other states have recognized the buy-and-bill model as a limitation to access and have removed this requirement for the treatment of substance use disorders, particularly in light of the opioid epidemic and need for access to these important medicines. Minnesota remains one of only a handful of states that still require this process. We are an outlier. The U.S. Government Accountability Office issued a report in 2020 calling out the Minnesota buy-and-bill Medicaid model as restricting providers from using methods best suited for their patients' practice, in turn affecting beneficiaries' access to the medications to treat substance disorders. Removing barriers to access for treatment is why the Opioid Epidemic Response Advisory Council, with Representatives Baker and Cagle as our House appointees, has included this policy change as a legislative priority for this year. You will note there is written testimony in support of House Bill 19 provided by the chair of ORAC, Dr. Ann Pilkus, who was set to testify today, but she is busy taking care of these very patients right now and couldn't get away. As a state, we need to update our statutes and remove barriers for patients to access these medicines so that providers can make prescribing decisions based on what medicine may be right for that patient, rather than making decisions based on a reimbursement model. So with that, I do have testifiers, including Dr. Emily Bruner, I think is here, Dr.
Yes, she is. I see her.
Wonderful.
Here. So thank you, Representative Morrison. And we'll hold questions until we get done with our testifiers here. So Dr. Bruner, welcome. If you would just state your name for the record and tell us who you're affiliated with and go ahead and give us your testimony.
Thanks so much. Madam Chair, members, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Dr. Emily Bruner, and I'm the immediate past president of the Minnesota Society of Addiction Medicine. As an addiction medicine specialist, I treat patients every day impacted by the disease of addiction. Many of these patients respond well to medications for addiction treatment, such as methadone, buprenorphine, and naltrexone. These medications come in many different formulations. Some are oral, while others are administered by clinicians in the form of long-acting injectables. Each patient I treat is unique and may respond to one formulation of MAT better than others. Addiction is an incredibly complex disease, and I need access to every formulation of MAT to ensure I am providing the best care possible for all of my patients. Unfortunately, the current buy and bill system for long-acting injectables in Minnesota creates obstacles to these treatments. Many addiction clinics and providers operate on very narrow profit margins and simply cannot afford to purchase these medications themselves. As with any disease, some patients will miss appointments or move to a different treatment plan, leaving clinics to absorb the cost of these expensive drugs. This situation has forced some clinics not to offer long-acting injectables at all. I am lucky enough to work in a clinic that does offer long-acting injectables, but my patients often endure significant delays when trying to receive their medications. Other members of MnSAM are not so fortunate and cannot administer long-acting injectables to their patients. I am thankful that Minnesota has taken the addiction crisis seriously. However, Minnesota's buy-and-bill requirements on long-acting injectables is an impediment to the individualized addiction care in the state. Other states have recognized that long-acting injectables are a critical part of the addiction medicine toolkit and have implemented policy changes to ensure that we can administer them quickly and efficiently. Removing the buy-in bill requirement is a critical next step that Minnesota can take to improve access to addiction treatment and save lives. Thank you again for the opportunity to speak today. I look forward to answering your questions.
All right. Thank you very much, Dr. Brunner. Appreciate that. So are there questions from members? Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee. Thank you to Representative Morrison for bringing this bill forward. But I wonder for our testifier, if you could give us some examples. I know Minnesota has been working really hard to make improvements, particularly on addictions and finding better ways to treat these issues as we move forward. But as a part of that comprehensive plan, could you help us better understand the actual patients that are using this medication and why it's so critical for them to have this long-acting form?
Dr. Brunner.
Yeah, so there's multiple medications, both an extended release form of Suboxone and an extended release form of Naltrexone. The oral form of Naltrexone, which is a medication that can treat either alcohol use disorder or opioid use disorder, is not as effective as the injectable form. In fact, the oral form of Naltrexone is not even recommended to be used in opioid use disorder at this time because of its ineffectiveness. However, we have huge delays in getting people the extended release form. For example, I just this morning saw a patient who actually it was the second time I've seen him who would like to get on extended release Naltrexone, but has had significant barriers, even though it says his insurance covers it. They make like 5 phone calls to him and keep pushing it off, kind of similar to a prior authorization. So we can't get it in for him, and it's resulted in, you know, relapses and delays. So we need the medications, you know, to be able to treat people appropriately because they're more efficacious and beneficial and prevent relapse.
Okay, so, thank you, Representative Bonner.
Madam Chair, thank you for that. So basically what you're saying here, if I'm understanding correctly, is that realistically, the very nature of the disease that we're treating here and the very nature of the patients who really can benefit and get better outcomes from this particular injectable medication are folks that may have challenges with other forms of the medication, but more specifically, adherence to actually have the tools in the toolbox to get better are really what we're after here. And that this long-term injectable is much better at ensuring better outcomes and making sure that we can get people on the right path to recover. Is that accurate?
Dr. Brunner?
Yeah, that's accurate. And I would also highlight that, you know, it's an especially important population to have the medication available right when a person would like to use it, as opposed to saying, you know, come back in 10 days. Like, that's not a very helpful paradigm for giving these to really impulsive people in early sobriety.
Okay, let's see, we've got Representative Quam and then Representative Ackland. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the questions is, I'm used to seeing the local pharmacies giving flu injections. And I believe they do some additional. Would there be a great deal of difficulty in having local pharmacies do this? And I'm not sure all local pharmacies do it. So maybe a little bit of enlightenment on the delta from where we're at to where we want to go, and what sort of training or documentation, and then, you know, additional percentage of pharmacies that might be doing it. Sorry about the confusion. I just don't know.
Dr. Brunner.
Both of these medications can precipitate opiate withdrawal if you don't do a detailed evaluation before, you know, deciding to use them. I'm not sure I mean, and I'm not a pharmacist, I'm not 100% sure of their paradigm and clinical, you know, how they feel about that. So my gut feeling is that it would be more appropriate to make it more available in clinic first before doing that.
Okay. And let me just pause here before I go to another member question. The staff is telling me we have another testifier on this bill, and I did not realize we do. Is that the case, Representative Morrison? Or if you may not know, but
there may have been a last minute change. I'm seeing.
Oh, is yes, that Dr. Wecker? Is that?
Yeah, it's Dr. John Uecker.
Oh, Dr. Uecker. Okay. All right, so members, before we go to your, we have a couple more members with hands up, but let's let Dr. Uecker, if it's okay with you, if you could hold your questions and let him give his testimony. I'm sorry, Dr. Uecker, you weren't on my list here, so I don't wanna miss you, but please go ahead, introduce yourself and give us who you're speaking for here.
I'm Jonathan Uecker. I'm the medical director for Nystrom and Associates. We have about 21 clinics throughout the state of Minnesota. We provide outpatient mental health and substance use disorder treatment. And I would like to, and Nystrom's would like to thank Representative Morrison for the work that she has done on this bill. And we support this bill. However, we would like to see it exceeding injectable meds used in mental health. And the group of the medicines that we're interested in adding are long-acting injectables that are used for treating schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. These would be medicines like Risperdal Consta, Abilify Maintena, Invega Trinza. And these medicines are usually administered monthly up to every 3 months. It is known that these medicines can decrease hospital admissions as much as 58% for this group of patients. And again, the big problem with this group of patients, as with many of our individuals who have severe substance use disorders, is impulsivity, non-adherence, non-recognition of, their need for treatment. And to really provide these medications for patients who are in the buy and bill process or program, it really becomes very complicated. We have okay. to refer
Dr. Uecker, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but what you're talking about is something that's not in the bill, and we're not able to even amend the bill today. So, you know, I appreciate your point of view, but I would really encourage you to talk with Representative Morrison offline about this, because we're okay. going off the topic of today's committee hearing, even though I do okay. see the link.
All right.
So was there anything right. else you wanted to say that was on the bill as it is written today?
No, just again, that we support the bill.
All right. Thank you so much. Appreciate that. All right. So let's see, I think that we had, I think that next on the list was Representative Ackland and then Dama.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for Dr. Bruner, I have a couple questions. One of them relates somewhat to Representative Squam's question, but my first question is this, is it common for pharmacies, and I'm talking about pharmacies around the state, for local pharmacies to actually keep this long-acting injectable drug on hand at all times also? Thinking if a patient's taking a prescription there, are they going to be assured that that prescription drug will be available? So that's one question. And the other one is it a usual practice? And these drugs, when you're dealing with substance abuse, I know there's a lot of times some very narrow parameters that patients need to follow in order to stay in these programs. My question is, if a patient is taking this drug once a month, would they also be required to see a physician once a month or as often as this injectable drug is to be given? And where I'm sort of leading with this is if they're already seeing the physician to get the prescription, it would probably be better just to give the injection then rather than giving them a prescription and sending them somewhere else. So that's sort of a two-part question, and thank you very much.
All right, Dr. Brunner?
Sure. We actually usually have to get this from specialty pharmacies, so it's not something, in my understanding, is typically in stock. We like order it from specialty pharmacies ahead of time, and it's quite frankly a huge pain in the posterior. And that's why most places don't do it. And so also we would definitely be seeing these patients monthly, sometimes more frequently than monthly. So for all those reasons, I think it makes sense to do it at the time of the appointment, not to space it out.
Representative Backlund?
So you're saying that the pharmacies, the local pharmacies, would need to order it out from a specialty pharmacy too, but do you think they would have it on hand at the time the patient had the appointment? That's my concern.
No, I don't think most pharmacies carry these in stock.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Representative Damon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Morrison, for bringing the bill forward. Just a question. The fiscal note came in just shortly before our committee started, and just with a quick glance over it, it looks like it would be about $400,000 per year, just a little bit over. The question to the fiscal note, though, is it looks like two new FTEs. Can you explain why maybe there would be two FTEs needed for the claims, or why that couldn't just be integrated already into the many employees that DHS already has?
Representative Morrison, can you tackle that?
Thank you, Chair Liebling, and great question, Representative David. I have not seen the fiscal note yet, and so I wouldn't be able to speak to it. I'll need some time to review it, but thanks for flagging that.
Okay, excellent. Nothing further, Madam Chair.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Representative Damath. And yeah, and I was going to mention, I did not know that the fiscal note had just been released either, but you know, we will have to look at that. We'll be discussing that before we will, you know, this bill's being laid over. So we were actually thinking we weren't even gonna have it today. So thank you for flagging that. Representative Bolden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is for Representative Morrison. Thank you for bringing this bill forward, as this certainly is a significant issue across our communities. My question is just in clarification. I'm wondering if I heard correctly or understood correctly that this sort of structure for payment or reimbursement of this medication is different in the managed care versus fee-for-service. Is that true?
And was that for, I'm sorry, was that for the author?
I believe it would be.
Do you know, Representative Morrison? Or we could ask Dr. Brunner to tackle that if she knows.
Madam Chair and Representative Bolden, that is my understanding, yes, that it is okay. Different.
And I wonder if, I think I saw Chad Hope on here from DHS, and he might be a person that could answer that question as well. Can I put you on the spot on that one, Mr. Hope? So this is, the question is, if managed care is handling this differently, or do we know how managed care is handling this? Mr. Hope, you might probably need to introduce yourself for the record as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Chad Hope, Deputy Director for the Division of Purchasing and Service Delivery at DHS. And Madam Chair, Representative, I believe the managed care organizations are doing a combination of both the medical and the pharmacy reimbursement. I can't speak to what degree that they restrict it to one versus the other. There are different models that are utilized, but it also, it plays into how the claims are reimbursed. So if the managed care organization has contracted this to their PBMs, that's a different claim adjudication than if they were administering it through their internal medical claim adjudication.
Representative Bolden? Okay, good. All right. Representative Backer, and then we're going to finish up on this one and move along. Representative Backer.
Yeah, just a really more a comment, and I appreciate Representative Dismiss pointing that out, but with over 6,000 employees in the department, I really think that they could find some people to help oversee this program. And I know the author is still working on it, so I'm just sharing that comment while we are going through this process before it comes back or included in the big bill at the end. So thank you.
All right. Thanks for flagging that, Representative Becker. And then I do have a question as well on this. And that is, first of all, Representative Morrison, I had cued you that I was going to ask about results first. If everybody remembers, way long ago at the beginning of the session, we had a presentation on that. Is there, when I looked at results first, kind of looking for anything about this, I know that it speaks to medication-assisted treatment. And then it has specific medications, but it was without knowing what medications this was, it was hard for me to figure out kind of what results first has to say about this. Could you speak to that, Representative Morrison?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my understanding is results first was published in 2017, but it does speak to one of the medications in this category, Vivitrol, and that one was rated as proven effective.
Okay, and speaking of Vivitrol, to my second question, which probably is more for Dr. Brunner, is are these brand name drugs? Are there generics available for all of them that are used? Or, you know, Vivitrol is the name that I've heard, and that seems to be a brand name drug. Is that one that is used, or is there an equivalent for that? Because that's, I'm understanding from this that these are very expensive drugs. Am I right about that? Dr. Brunner.
I think they're expensive drugs, and it's Vivitrol and Sublocade are probably the two in this category, and they're both brand name right now.
Okay, and that probably is part of why the fiscal note is what it is. So, all right, well, thank you very much. So we are going to appreciate our testifiers today, and thank you, Representative Morrison. So House File 19 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. Thank you. All right, I see we have Representative Hassan with us now. So the chair will move House File 1419 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. And Representative Hassan, I understand you have an author's amendment. Would you like to move that right now?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right. And so we can just put it on the bill, and then you can discuss the bill as in the form that you would like. So so the chair is going to move the author's amendment, the A1, to put the bill in the proper form. And so we'll just do a voice vote on that. Are there any questions to that before we get it on the bill? Seeing none. So if you would unmute yourselves, members, all in favor of adoption of the A1, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So now it's all yours, Representative Hassan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I had two bills up at the same time, so that's why.
It's all right.
Madam Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to present House File 1419 relating to health, creating a public awareness campaign on the dangers of using skin lightening creams containing mercury. They say beauty is in the eyes of beholder, but I say beauty is in the eyes of those who set the standards for society. Our beauty standards are centered around Eurocentric view of the world. To shed a light on how troubling and far spread this skin lightening issue is, let's look at our beauty standards in the United States. We have a history of considering fair skinned folks to be more desirable than folks with darker skin complexion. If you travel far east in China, you will find the same beauty standards that are centered around fair skin. Not to mention India's caste system is based on Eurocentric view beauty standards as well as social class. In Africa, where almost everyone is Black, we still have the same struggles around this fair skin issue. Why are we talking about fair skin issue? Well, women are using creams filled with mercury and other toxins to brighten their skin so they can have a fairer skin and considered beautiful by our society. They are endangering their health and their children's health. With that, Madam Chair, I have a testifier who has been working on this issue for almost as long as I know her. Amira Adawi, who will give us a brief overview of this issue. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hassan. Ms. Adaway, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and member of the committee. My name is Amira Adawi. I'm the executive director of the Beautiful Project, which is a nonprofit that is focusing on combating colorism and skin lighting and chemical exposures in communities of color. I have been working on this issue, both research and engaging communities, for more than 10 years now. Many women of color are using multiple skin lighting products. They're mixing multiple chemicals, products that contain mercury, products that contain hydroquinone and steroids. And so they use twice or three times a day. Women are using during pregnancy and when they're breastfeeding, which we know that mercury exposure is even higher during these times. It can pass through the fetus to the child and also to the breast milk. And so we're worrying about a lot of exposure during pregnancy, but also during early childhood development. These women who are using these products during preconception care time, they're getting exposed to so much chemicals, and many of them, they don't understand the health literacy around chemical exposures and how it's impacting their health. And so we have been working with women to understand this issue, both the public health implication, but also environmental implication, because these toxic products are ending up in the environment, but also the psychological impact, because many of these women, like Representative Hassan said, they believe beauty standard that is only based on white. And so the ideology that only if you're white, you're beautiful, it's the reason that many of these women are using. So through Beautywell, we have tested more than 500 products that contained high levels of mercury, up to 150 parts per million, which is extremely toxic. And so in 2019, the legislation that you supported helped us to expand the work that we do to educate communities, but also expand our reach to greater Minnesota and conduct focus group sessions, key informant interviews in these communities and talk to them about this issue. And so it's a huge issue, that it's a huge public health issue, huge maternal child health issue that's predominantly impacting women of color in the state of Minnesota. And it's a huge global issue, but we're having this issue in our state here in Minnesota. And so I'm testifying today in support of this bill, and the work that you're doing to support this issue is very important. I'm here to answer any question that you have. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much, Ms. Adaway. And I'll just ask a real couple quick questions. I don't think you covered this piece, but these products with mercury are illegal in this country, right? This is not something where we're talking about banning something from being sold. These are not supposed to be sold, correct?
Yeah, so these products are illegal in the state of Minnesota and FDA, but people are still finding ways to import and sell. And then people are also buying from online retailers. In 2019, we created a campaign to go after Amazon, where they removed 15 products that we tested that had contained high levels of mercury. So people are accessing both online retailers and in-store retailers here, where we don't have good regulatory system, and it's banned. Mercury is banned here in the state of Minnesota and federal level as well.
Okay, thank you very much for that. And the other thing I just wanted to maybe have you talk just really briefly, add to this, is we're not only talking about women from Africa, right? We're talking about women with all kinds of ethnic backgrounds. I had understood that the Hmong community, this was a real problem. Could you just give us a sort of, I think Representative Hassan talked about this some, but like, this is a pretty broad-based problem, right?
Yeah, it's a very broad-based problem. Like you said, Madam Chair and Representative Hassan said, this is a global issue. And so countries in Africa, Asia, and Latin America do practice skin lighting. And so in Minnesota, we have communities that are from India, other parts of Asia, communities, you know, like the Hmong communities, Latinx communities. We work with all of these communities. In Greater Minnesota, we just started working with the South Sudanese communities and some of the Burmese communities, like the Karen communities. And so it's impacting many immigrant communities, but also the African American communities that are here from America. And so it's a huge issue that's impacting all communities of color.
All right, thank you so much. So I don't see any questions. Representative Hassan, would you like to have the final word before? Oh, I do see one question. Representative Dana.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hassan, for bringing this forward. I appreciate what the testifier also shared. As you're talking about the other communities that are facing these challenges, how are you getting the word out, and is that part of it here? That's the first question. The second part of the question is, do we have Minnesota data specifically that is showing higher levels of mercury that is showing up for whatever reason, so we can actually look back at health data that may be directly attributed to this?
Yeah, so we're reaching out.
Mr. Dawe.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. We're reaching out to communities in various ways. We hold community sessions. Now we move to everything to virtual through Zoom. We have been collecting, meeting with communities and doing focus group session team from interviews through Zoom. So we disseminate, we develop videos and materials, and so we share through ethnic media, different ethnic media like the Hmong TV, the Somali TV, and the other the Latinx communities TV. And then also we have a program called Young Women's Wellness and Leadership Initiative, where we recruit young girls from different high schools, and they go through 16 weeks of cohort-based training about what this issue is, what these chemicals are, to build their health literacy around this issue, but also uplift them and help them see representation. Because a lot of times when young people don't see representation of people who look like them, that's also impacting them. So how do we build them? How do we address the root causes of this and engage communities? And so we engage communities through radio show as well and podcasts. So we engage in various different ways, making sure that they understand, the health issue, but also how do we redefine beauty and address some of these implications. And then to answer your question in terms of data, the Minnesota Department of Health did biomonitoring research a couple years ago, where they found women from the East African communities, the Hmong communities, and Latinx communities have higher mercury exposure from the skin lighting products. And so that was done through biomonitoring research. And I believe the Department of Health was continuing to do that in some of the community-based clinics to continue and find, not only did they find mercury in their urine, when they went to their homes, the homes tested positive for mercury air, you know? So exposure is not only limited to those who are using, but also those who live with them and those who are visiting them, since mercury was available through the air that they're breathing on. So the exposure is very high, and the department was able to document through biomonitoring research.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Ms. Adawe, and Representative Hassan. Representative Hassan, did you want to say something before we lay the bill over?
No, I just want to say this issue, it's about racial equity. It's also about gender equity, because many of the people that are using this product are women. And it's about saving little babies from toxins. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you both. So House File 1419 is laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. Thank you. Okay, we will move now back to Representative Morrison, and Representative Morrison will move House File 256. And 256 to be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if you just indulge me one moment, I was hoping to get one final word on House File 19. There was a reference to it being expensive. And I just wanted to make...
Representative Morrison, we can't do that. We're now on 256. I'm sorry. We can, there will be another opportunity, believe me.
Okay. So I'm pleased to present House File 256, a bill that would direct DHS to work with stakeholders to develop a health home model that would provide effective and much more cost-efficient care for our state's homeless population. Under the Affordable Care Act, the federal government allowed states to develop two health home models to coordinate care for complex patient populations. To date, Minnesota has developed one, the behavioral health home. A health home model under the ACA integrates physical and behavioral health and other services and supports for higher need, higher cost Medicaid populations. By better coordinating care and linking people to needed service, health homes are designed to improve healthcare quality and reduce costs. This bill simply directs the Department of Human Services to request federal grant funds to establish recuperative care services for people experiencing homelessness as a health home model under the Affordable Care Act. There is no cost to this bill, although I see that a fiscal note just came through that I haven't seen yet, so I'll have to look at that. These types of models are used throughout the country and often are known as respite services. A number of for-profit HMOs around the country have developed these models because they save dollars by letting people heal and recuperate in healthy, safe, and clean environments after a healthcare event, rather than cycling in and out of the emergency department. Think about the last time you or loved one were hospitalized or underwent a surgery. Imagine you had an emergency appendectomy. You recovered enough that you no longer needed to stay in the hospital, so you went home to rest and continue recovering. Remember the drive home? I remember those after surgery. Every bump is uncomfortable and very painful in some cases. Maybe your partner or other family members brought you chicken noodle soup, helped tend your incision, make sure you had your medications, got you to your follow-up appointments, and made sure you didn't move around more than the doctor ordered. Now imagine you didn't even have a home to return to after being in the hospital. You're well enough to be discharged from the hospital, but certainly still unwell enough that staying on the streets or in an overnight shelter will make recovery nearly impossible. Without proper nutrition or being able to rest, without a safe place to store your medications or wound care supplies, having to move around in the community with everything you own during the day, taking care of yourself is incredibly difficult. That's where recuperative care can come into play. Last year, I had the opportunity to tour a shelter in downtown Minneapolis where Hennepin Healthcare for the Homeless is providing care to patients experiencing homelessness. The Hennepin County Healthcare for the Homeless program works to decrease barriers to accessing healthcare by bringing critical services to the homeless population by locating clinics within emergency shelter and other services. The current recuperative care services in the shelter are very limited and covered by small amounts of dollars from partners. This particular bill only deals with the service portion of medical recuperative care services. It doesn't address the shelter or the housing portion of care. This health home model will ensure that patients have the services they need while having a place to stay off the streets to properly recover, improve health outcomes, and prevent avoidable returns to the emergency room or readmissions to a hospital. A number of health systems and nonprofit groups are supportive of this legislation, and you should have received those letters of support. I do have the testifier, Dr. Robert Shaw, who is the medical director of Hennepin Healthcare for the Homeless, here to share her extensive experience related to this model.
All right. Thank you, Representative Morrison. Dr. Robert Shaw, welcome. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Wonderful. And thank you so much, Representative Morrison. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Morrison, thank you so much for allowing me the opportunity to be here today. As mentioned, my name is Danielle Robertshaw, and I serve as the medical director for Hennepin County's Healthcare for the Homeless program. I've also been a physician who's provided care for patients experiencing homelessness for almost 20 years, and my experience very much reflects what decades of research has confirmed. My homeless patients are more likely than their house counterparts to get sick at younger ages, present in acute and preventable crises situations relating to chronic health problems, and die younger. Average age of death in the chronically homeless U.S. adult is around 47 years, despite an average life expectancy of nearly 80 years in the U.S. For context, in the U.S., that is equivalent to the life expectancy in the year 1900. Homeless shelters are ill-equipped to serve the medical complexity of the clients walking in their doors, and hospitals are often overwhelmed trying to find safe discharge plans once somebody is medically stable. Patients are rarely in a place to prioritize recovering from an illness when faced with the competing priorities of daily survival when on the street or in an overnight shelter. Recuperative care is a model that's been around for over 30 years in this country, and I like to think of it as a win-win-win, serving to close gaps for the shelters, the healthcare system, and the patients. Currently, there are a few small programs connected to health systems in the state, but they are not reimbursed by Medicaid, making them limited in availability and difficult to sustain. Basics of a recuperative care program include a safe and recuperative environment with 24/7 access to a bed, 3 meals a day, and support services, where somebody can stay for a short period of time to recuperate. Years of data tell us that having a time where you can get adequate sleep, nutrition, put your feet up and feel safe is an important part of recovery. For many of us, we have a safe place to go when we leave the hospital, and family or friends to care for us, healthy food to eat as we recover. For those in our community without this, recuperative care provides that safe space and supports, which allows someone to be able to focus on their health and receive connection to ongoing services such as care coordination, mental health, substance use disorder treatment, and housing. Recuperative care can decrease some seemingly insurmountable pressures for a number of systems. As a healthcare provider, I am very excited about the better health outcomes, but also in connecting people to lower cost, more appropriate medical services such as primary care, and then decreasing the use of costly acute services like 911 and EMS, emergency departments, and hospitalizations. Multiple peer-reviewed publications have spoken to these shifts in care and the outcomes to recuperative care. One recent spoke to the financial savings, which was published in 2017. The study was funded by a CMS innovation grant. It was a 3-year multi-study site across the US that showed a statistically significant and sustained reduction in total Medicaid payment per enrollee of 24% after a recuperative care stay, from $1,650 a month to $1,250 a month. As a healthcare provider, I'm also excited when this financial benefit is in support of doing the right thing. I encounter patients every day that would be much better served by recuperative care than a revolving door of acute care services. I know some on this committee have heard this story before, and I apologize for that. Many patients stick out in my mind over the years, but one that always comes to mind when I think about recuperative care and those we miss is my patient, John. He was new to our clinic on the day we met. I was at Harbor Light Shelter Clinic, and he came in to request Tylenol for muscle aches, a seemingly simple request. And then we started talking, and I asked about the cause of his muscle aches, and his story was anything but simple. He was in his early 40s and had been diagnosed with terminal cancer 8 months earlier. He was divorced, had 2 young children that lived with their mother in a neighboring state. He'd been homeless for several years despite having a steady but low-paying job. Between the pain from the cancer and the chemotherapy side effects, he'd not been able to work for the last few months. The social worker at his cancer doctor's office was working on getting him into a charity or free hospice facility, but there was a wait list. So he slept in an overnight shelter, went to the library during the day with all of his belongings to try to sleep, and rarely had energy to access meal programs around town or make it to all of his doctor's appointments. And when he became dehydrated and overwhelmed enough by pain and chemo side effects, he'd force himself to go to the emergency department. He'd been admitted to the hospital 2 of the 3 times he went within the last few weeks. He was at the point where he and his doctor were talking about stopping the chemo. He knew he was dying, and he really only had 2 goals in life. He wanted to get off the chemo and hopefully feel well enough to at least briefly travel and visit his children, and 2, have his name come to the top of the hospice wait list so he wouldn't die on the street. I often reflect back, struck by this man who was younger than me and was making end-of-life goals and decisions without even a place to call home. His goals were not extravagant and should not have seemed so basic and yet so fraught with uncertainty. I think about what it might have meant to him to be able to offer recuperative care as a bridge to hospice, but all I could offer was the Tylenol he requested. There's an unfortunate number of stories that I could share to support the need for adequate, accessible, and sustainable recuperative care programs that would better serve Minnesotans who are ill and experiencing homelessness. I appreciate the many partners, including individuals, health systems, DHS, and other stakeholder groups who've contributed to this work and provided the opportunity to bring this bill forward. I will hope you support the use of health homes to create a Medicaid benefit that will help pay for the vital care coordination and wraparound services that are not currently reimbursable. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Robertshaw. We have several members with questions. And before we go to them, I would just like to, looking at the language of the bill, Representative Morrison, do you know why the last couple lines of the bill say that the commissioner must not seek federal funding or a federal approval of any additional health home service models prior to the development of the recuperative health home model?
Madam Chair, it looks like Tara Erickson is wanting to respond to that, but I think the intent is to not use available money for a different health home model, but I will defer to her.
Okay, well, all right. Well, Ms. Erickson, go ahead if you can do it briefly, and then I'm gonna go to member questions. Go ahead.
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tara Erickson, and I'm the contract lobbyist for Hennepin County Medical Center. Representative Liebling, to your question, this they're under the ACA, the feds only allowed two health home models. What the language says is that we don't want another type of model to take this slot for us. We want to use the homeless population to be able to take the other health home model under the ACA. So this is not something just for HCMC. Once this model is developed, then hospitals and shelters could partner around the state to do the exact same program that we're doing. This just develops the model. It can okay. be replicated throughout the state.
All right, thank you. Representative Ryer, then Hewitt, then Bonner. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this may be for the author, but my question is, having spent a lot of time in the Housing and Preventing Homelessness Committees, we've been hearing a lot about different models with housing for supported services for people coming out of homelessness. And so I'm interested in what additional type of service would be part of the recuperative health home. Is there a medical practitioner level that is part of this more explicitly that sets it aside, sets it apart?
Dr. Robertshaw?
Sure, I'll take that, thank you. So, and I believe Representative Ryder might be referring to are the housing stabilization Medicaid services. So this particular model is very much focused on recuperation from illness. So you're correct. There is a lot of medical type services depending on the model. So all of them will include some type of care coordination. So ensuring that you're getting your durable medical equipment, your medications, making it to appointments, getting transportation for those appointments scheduled while you're in recuperative care. Many programs do have the ability to actually have prescriber level providers available, but not all. So it's going to depend on how you're partnering and how you're framing it. But those would be separate from this Medicaid benefit because for the majority of people, those provider services are billable separately.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Robert Shaw, this may be directed towards you. My wife is a home care nurse and she deals with, she's got a few patients on her census that are homeless. And I'm just curious if your statistics really do point towards, because we always wondered this, of the ones that, I mean, if you don't have a refrigerator, the insulin's not going to do you any well. If you can't keep the wound clean, if you're going to fail. Do you have hard facts on the people that fail and basically returning back? Do you have the data that shows that these people usually end up in the ER again, costing the system more money, or is that more anecdotal?
Dr. Robertshaw.
Pardon me, thank you. Great question, Representative Hewitt. So yes, we do have actually several decades of data, and all of them have taken a various focus on whether it's looking at length of stay, readmissions in the hospital, ED utilization. Most of them have looked at it from a recuperative care standpoint of those who make it into a program, how do they fare differently or better than those who didn't? And so we do have in that data, not only on those who didn't get into respite, but showing the benefits of those who are in respite.
Representative Hewitt.
And thank you for that. And Representative Morris, this is a great bill. I mean, even when I was working on the truck still and seeing people that just were discharged and they ended up sleeping on the street or something, and we haven't returned them back within 12 hours of that costing the system so much money at that point. This is great legislation, and this is why we're here, because it will save us down the line. Thank you, Representative Morrison, for this.
All right, thank you, Representative Hewitt. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Morrison, for this bill. I'll try to be brief because I know some of it is a little bit similar to what Representative Hewitt said. I mentioned before that my
My mother was a nurse at Hennepin County for 43 years, from emergency room and urgent care to the head of the cardiac unit. And one of the conversations that was frequently brought up at our dinner table was some of these very cases where the staff was heartbroken caring for a patient that they knew was going to end up back on the street and very likely within a short amount of time would show up again in their ER or end up readmitted because they couldn't do the proper wound care, because they couldn't maintain their medications and make sure that they got them in a timely fashion. So, you know, really this bill is about creating a model that fills in the gaps that we haven't been able to fill for literally decades. And this is about doing the right thing for better patient outcomes, but it's also about saving money in terms of making sure that we don't have folks having to come back again and again and again to care for issues that are now much worse than they would have been if we could have just done the right thing and gotten them the right care when they needed it. And so thank you for this bill. Thank you for bringing it forward. And hopefully we can get this done this year.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bonner. And I do just want to point out to members that we do have a fiscal note on this bill. And it shows a cost over the biennium of $203,000. And there's some narrative there, and it does show needing, I think if I saw it correctly here, it shows one additional FTE to do planning, I think. So members did have this in the packet. I know these notes are coming in very quickly now. And frankly, I've just been looking at it here too, if you see me kind of looking off the side of my other computer and I'm looking at the fiscal note while listening to the testifier. So, we can also have more discussion about this later on. So with that, I guess my question, Dr. Robert Shaw is, and I see we have one more member here, but I just need a little clarity about, I know this question's been kind of asked, but I'm just still a little bit unclear about what this gives us in addition to what we already have, because I'm pretty sure that right now HCMC is not just discharging homeless people on the street after they're done with their hospital care, right? And I did hear you say that we don't have services all over the place that we need. So maybe we do need more consistency, but I don't think what we're talking here is this or we don't have services. So I'm just trying to understand exactly what the add is here. Could you address that, Dr. Robert Shaw?
Sure, I'll do my best. Thank you very much, Representative Liebling. So I will say in the Twin Cities, we're probably more flush in resources than other places, although that isn't necessarily a pretty thing. We do have several beds held aside at Harbor Light Shelter, which is the shelter that Representative Morrison visited. It is neither recuperative or a pleasant environment. We have a healthcare for the homeless team that is there, so patients can also come down and access services there. Many, many patients decline to go there. And so we have a number of patients that actually do discharge to the street because they're not interested in going to Harbor Light Shelter. So I think part of it is being able to expand beds, because we certainly also have way more patients than the beds would allow, take some onus off the patient to pay for it, because right now patients pay for a stay at the Harbor Light Shelter and partner differently with the people in the different services. So we can provide from Healthcare for the Homeless a lot of the care coordination, but we also want to be connecting people with substance use services and other things like that. So a much more robust program, I think, than we have. So more beds, better environment, better services, at least locally. I do know up in northern Minnesota, there was a number of health systems that had requested some technical assistance to kind of think about how they could start something up there. I haven't heard that they've been able to do that yet, but they certainly were interested in supporting this bill. So I do think while we are sort of flush in resources, and again, I use that kind of air quotes, that there is certainly others in the state who could benefit.
All right, appreciate that explanation. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This isn't even a
a question. It is just a big thank you to Dr. Robert Shaw for being here today and going over this bill again, and to the bill's author. You know, this is only my second term, but I've heard this bill twice now. I don't want to hear it a third time next session. So I would really like to get this one done. Clearly, with the evidence and the data you've shown and your story, you just reiterated again here today, we know that the key is treating people when they need it, and that this will save time and it will save money and it definitely will save lives. So thanks for bringing it forward.
All right. Thank you. Representative Morrison, do you want the final word here, and then we'll lay the bill over?
Thank you, Madam Chair, for considering this important bill to protect our most vulnerable Minnesotans.
Okay. Thank you. And so with that, House File 256 is laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. Thank you, Representative Morrison. And thank you to Dr. Robert Shaw. Okay, Representative Bierman has House File 633. And so Representative Bierman is going to move that House File 633 be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. And Representative Bierman, it's all yours.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members, to be here today to listen to this bill. It's no secret that healthcare costs, including the costs of prescription medications, continue to be a challenge for everyone. Patients, providers, insurers, and policymakers alike. We hear from our constituents every day about these challenges. They want us to work towards solutions that get to the core of these problems, but they also expect us to look for relief options where possible. House File 633 helps provide relief to people on the individual and small group markets who face costly monthly prescriptions, and does so with a minimum impact to the health insurance market. My bill would require plans in these markets to offer products that have copays on all prescription drug benefits, with the highest drug copays capped at 1/12 of the annual maximum out-of-pocket. These copays are pre-deductible, so that the plan member doesn't have to write a check of several thousand dollars before coverage begins. This benefit offering is just like your local utility, allowing you to spread out your natural gas expenses over the full year. Patients still pay fully for the prescription drug benefits they're using over the course of the year, but without the heavy burden of thousands of dollars in upfront deductible and co-insurance costs in January and February. This same benefit policy has worked well in Colorado since 2016 and guarantees that people whose lives and well-being rely on access to costly medications can find individual and small group coverage that makes their monthly drug bills more manageable. The difference in premiums is modest, typically a few percentage points, and is borne only by those people who choose to buy the copay-only product. Meanwhile, the insurance market in Colorado has shown no negative impacts from this regulation, and consumers are able to find products to meet their needs. Turning our attention to the text of the bill itself, HF 633 would add a new subdivision 6 to Minnesota statutes, which sets out our essential health benefit package requirements for health insurance. Lines 1.8 to 1.7 of my bill refer to the individual and small group markets respectively. Each segment requires that health insurers who do business in these markets must make sure that at least 25% of the plans they sell include a copay-only prescription drug benefit. The 25% requirement is consistent for all coverage levels, bronze, silver, and gold. Lines 1.18 to 1.20 define the highest allowable copayment, 1/12 of the annual maximum out-of-pocket payment for an individual. In many cases, this is still a high payment, but it is better than a deductible plus co-insurance. Lines 2.1 to 2.6 clarify expectations for how insurers name and market these products. If consumers cannot count on being able to easily identify which products contain the copay-only benefit, it will be harder for them to find their way to these products if preferred, or away from these products if not preferred. Likewise, these products should be available to all individual and small group customers and should be advertised alongside the regular slates of products available for purchase. Finally, lines 2.7 to 2.8 establishes that these products will be available as of January 1st, 2022. Members, please note the large number of endorsing patient organizations for this bill. It has widespread support because it will bring relief to patients now. Madam Chair, I would like to invite a couple testifiers to speak and explain their support for the bill, please.
All right, thank you, Representative Bierman. Appreciate that. And first on the list, I have Dana Bacon. Mr. Bacon, welcome.
Thank you. If you don't mind, may we do Dr. Arnold first, please?
Oh, surely, if that's okay. Sorry, Mr. Bacon. I'm just reading them off in the order I've got them, but I have no, it's just fine. Mr. Arnold, welcome.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Brian Arnold. I'm a licensed pharmacist from Plymouth. I have 16 years experience with the most recent 6 years in Minnesota. In 2016, I became a specialty pharmacist with a focus in oncology, particularly bloodborne cancers. As a specialty pharmacist, I provide services including side effect management, drug utilization review, and most importantly, proactive adherence programs, including a top barrier to medication access, elevated and potentially unpredictable patient out-of-pocket costs. I am here today to support File 633 to make the already high out-of-pocket costs for patients more predictable. Medical advancements have produced medications that are absolutely amazing. There's no denying these treatments extend life expectancy while maintaining a high quality of life. These meds also come with a huge price tag. I see firsthand how hard it can be for patients with a specialty disease state such as multiple myeloma, a bloodborne cancer, to cover their prescription costs. One cycle of oral medications to effectively treat a bloodborne cancer such as multiple myeloma is upwards of $25,000 per month without insurance coverage. The initial out-of-pocket cost for most insurance plans includes the entire deductible as well as a copay on top of it. In January of each year, the resulting out-of-pocket cost ranges from $2,500 to $5,000 for that first bill. I will leave you with a closing scenario. Most plans reset your deductible at the first of every year. Imagine you or a loved one are diagnosed with a disease requiring a high out-of-pocket cost in the second half of the year. Are you willing to pay a deductible at the end of the year to turn right around and pay the full amount again in January? Or do you delay treatment of a life-saving medication until after January 1st to manage costs? This is a conversation I have every year with oncologists and newly diagnosed patients. This scenario is real. Vote yes for House File 633 to evenly level out the out-of-pocket costs throughout the year for Minnesotans. Thank you for your time and consideration.
All right, thank you so much, Mr. Arnold. Okay, now to you, Mr. Bacon.
Great, welcome. Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Dana Bacon. I live in Rosemount, and I'm the State Government Affairs Director for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. People living with chronic conditions often rely on costly medications to keep them alive and well, and we know that finding practical ways to balance the burden of these costs matters a lot. LLS, my organization, is one of 12 medical and patient advocacy groups supporting this bill today, and we'd like to thank Representative Bierman and his bipartisan slate of co-authors for bringing this proposal forward. In your hearing packets, you have a letter from a deputy commissioner with Colorado's Division of Insurance responding to questions I had about the practical impact of the copay plan requirements they have in their state for their individual and small group markets. I'd encourage you to take a close look at this letter when you decide whether to support House File 633 and when deciding whether this policy can help Minnesota consumers. Starting in 2016, Colorado consumers have had stable access to bronze, silver, and gold plans with both copay and non-copay options for the prescription drug benefit. Only the people who are choosing the copay benefit see a premium increase, and it's pretty small. It's between 0% and 8%, depending on the insurer. I say it's small because the people who choose these products need relief from pretty startling out-of-pocket expenses in the first month or two of the year. We find that the people who are choosing these products, again, according to the letter, are no more likely to drop their coverage than other people. And finally, we've found that Colorado's requirement to offer these products has had no impact on the well-being of their health insurance market. So we know we don't need a study to know that these plans work. And with your support, we can give patients with serious and chronic diseases an affordable, predictable coverage option for the prescriptions with no impact on the health of the individual and small group markets. So in close, I'd just like to ask for the committee's support for House File 633 so that we can get this proven relief plan available in all corners of Minnesota. Thanks for your time.
All right, thank you very much. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Bierman, for this bill. Real quick question, I don't even know if you know the answer to this, but I'm just curious, did this program by any chance stabilize or do anything to the formulary changing?
Representative Bierman.
Madam Chair, Representative Hubert, I'm not sure, are you asking whether it would, or are you asking whether it has in Colorado?
Yeah. Well, I'm in Colorado is what I'm wondering about. Sorry. Colorado is what I'm wondering about, that if it did stabilize their formulary at all, I mean, this would be a side benefit of this program.
Representative Bierman.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Hewitt, so we'll let Mr. Bacon give us an answer to that question. But as far as this particular bill here in Minnesota, we would not be doing anything about formularies directly. So,
okay. It looks like he wants to answer. Mr. Bacon.
Madam Chair, Representative Hewitt, the regulation that Colorado has is multifaceted. There is a component of that regulation that speaks specifically to formularies. And when we were introducing this legislation, we chose not to pursue it. What they've done in Colorado additionally deals with discrimination in formularies. And they've placed a requirement that no more than 50% of the drugs to primarily treat a condition may be placed in the top formulary tier. We felt that there were sufficient ACA provisions to prevent us from having to introduce that in the language now. I would note that Colorado's Department of Insurance is also currently considering a change to its regulation to make it more stringent, recognizing that there are some medications administered medically instead of through oral medications. And we will be watching that with interest.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. And I have a question for Representative Bierman, since I haven't seen any other member questions here. And that one, Representative Bierman, is about why 25% of the plans? I mean, why don't we just do it for all the plans? Let me just back up, you know, rather than just and preface my question, you know, by saying that to me, this problem just is another illustration of how the whole insurance model doesn't fit healthcare. It's just crazy for people to have to pay these kind of out of pockets. You know, they pay a lot of money for their insurance and then they basically don't have any until they've paid lots and lots of money to be covered. And it just seems to me that the only reason for that is, I don't know, it would be nice if the health plans were here to explain why they need to do that to people, but it doesn't make much sense to me. And I doubt it makes much sense to many of the users of insurance, why they pay so much money for insurance and then essentially don't have any. So why in this bill, Representative Bierman, why are we only saying 25% of the plans have to do this, or they have to do this in 25% of their products?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the question. And it's a very good question. You expand the whole issue of our health insurance system, our medical system, and the extreme costs that we are all coming under through insurance, basically, the high cost of healthcare, the high cost of every service and drug that we use increases the cost of the insurance. So if we were to broaden it to such a degree and have such a bill, then perhaps what the plans are asking for in their letter to the committee today would have some standing as far as really needing to analyze this and slow this down. But this bill was designed to do what I said in my first sentence of this presentation, that our constituents expect us to look for relief options now where possible. And this is a relief option that we know will work because it's been proven in other states. And it's expandable. So I think that, that's something that we can look forward to the future. This committee, you know, we are assigned to address these high costs of healthcare, and there's other bills that get right at the core of the problem, the high cost of drugs, and we need to be paying attention to those and voting accordingly. But certainly there's more work to do in the insurance side of this as well, but this is a plan that I don't think it's an onerous lift for the insurance companies to be able to do their actuarial values and make this work in Minnesota like it has in Colorado, like it is going to work over in other states in New Jersey and California. And, you know, we keep working on it. So it's a step forward. Immediate help, and the patient groups are advocating for this as well.
Okay, well, thank you for that, Representative Bierman. And I wonder if Mr. Bacon, did you want to add anything to that? I mean, that was a really good, well-thought-out answer. And anything you want to throw in there? No. Okay. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Also, I got a question for Representative Bierman. So, you know, the insurance companies don't seem too excited about this, but this is just an option. You're not, they just have to offer it as an option to people under 65 that want to purchase this benefit. Is that correct, Representative Bierman?
Representative Bierman.
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, this would be plans that would be offered on their array of offerings to people. Nobody's required to buy this plan. It is complete choice. I am saying that they need to advertise it accordingly, and though that advertising can be as simple as two words, co-payment and pre-deductible needs to show up so that people know what they're looking for and they know what they're able to purchase, and that it would be balanced throughout their plan structure. But nobody is mandated to buy this plan.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you. So it wouldn't apply to people over 65 and over, correct?
Representative Bierman.
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, if they've signed up for Medicare or they're on a plan where they, or if they're in the, you know, any sort of health plan that is through, you know, the military or retirement, I mean, that's a separate way for them to get their insurance.
Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I, you know, I'm always a little skeptical when government wants to do something to help healthcare, since it's been mostly bad, their help. And in fact, it's driven up premiums, reduced access, and brought costs up. I do think if it's offered as an option, where, you know, people can tape it as an option onto their current plan for additional premium, I think that might work. I'd like to hear from the plans, but they're not here to testify on it. But otherwise, my initial thought is, as an option to existing plans, I think it does seem practical. So anyway, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Bierman.
All right. Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. And Mr. Bacon, anything you want to throw in here?
I would just, Madam Chair, I would just restate what Representative Bierman said, that this creates options. If 100 Minnesotans or 10,000 Minnesotans buy this product, that's between them and the people selling the products. We just want to make sure that this is available as a choice.
Yeah, thank you. And I just would, I guess, say in response to Representative Grunhagen, to his kind of underlying premise, you know, insurance is classically one of those things that has to be regulated. And why? Because otherwise, a person would be paying their money and really having no idea if they're going to get what they're paying for. So this is a product that I would just state pretty much couldn't exist without regulation. Now, we could debate how much regulation is appropriate and what we need to regulate and so on, how much freedom the insurance industry should have. But for example, if you're going to buy an insurance policy, you're handing over your money for risks to be covered. And so you could hand over your money if there was no regulation, and some unscrupulous company, when you go to say, okay, I want to make an appointment with a doctor, they could say, well, you know, fooled you. There's no doctor in our network. You know, so I mean, we can, as I say, we can debate how much is appropriate to regulate, but the bottom line is that regulation and our involvement is necessary to make sure that when people pay out these many thousands of dollars, that they actually get what they're paying for. I think that is pretty much the very least that people can expect from their government. So,
yeah, Madam Chair.
Representative Gruenhagen.
Yeah, just in response, I understand a certain amount of regulation. The problem is when government mandates benefits, that's where they get into problems. And we see that with abomination care, okay? Remember we had a report a couple sessions ago in 2017? I think 1.7 million Minnesotans did not access the care they needed because of high premiums and high deductibles brought about by abomination care.
Well, Representative Gruenhagen, I mean, the balance there, and I'm going to, after this, I'm going to go to Representative Bierman, let him finish up. But, you know, the balance there is, do we let consumers say, do we let companies say, here's a product, and then when the consumer goes to use it, they're told, oh no, that's not covered. Oh no, you have cancer? I'm so sorry, cancer's not covered. Well, you know, again, if we don't have a set of benefits that people know what they're buying, this is what happens, and this is what used to happen all the time. So anyway, with that, Representative Bierman, I'll give you the final word, and then we will lay the bill over.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank the members for their attention and their good questions and conversation on the bill. This bill, I know, will help Minnesotans afford their lives better, and I appreciate all of your consideration. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bierman. So with that, House File 633 is laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. And thank you to our two testifiers as well. So with that, members, just to preview for you our next meeting, which is tomorrow, 3 o'clock, we're going to first start out with a budget forecast update on the Health and Human Services budget. Then we're going to hear House File 1183 from Representative Stevenson about price gouging in the prescription market. We're going to hear House File 1339 from Representative Pinto, which is about a pilot program or a study about economic assistance in St. Paul. And then we're going to hear House File 521 from Representative Morrison. So with that, I look forward to seeing you all tomorrow, and we are adjourned.